When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 337th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Emilio Torres and Scott Burkhart. Interesting fact, they were both patrons before, they were both on our patron list, but somehow they became patrons this past week, which means that people have cracked the code. If you want to get your name mentioned again, you just stop being a patron, and then you restart being a patron. Oftentimes at a lower patron level, and then you get your name mentioned again. So, I don't know, Matt. What do you think about that?
Listen, I think it's an okay move, and also, who knows, maybe their credit card number changed and they wanted to re-sign up or something. I don't know, man.
Guys, we love you. Scott Burkhart, Emilio Torres. Emilio, we owe you an email. I'm Oren Kaplan.
I'm Matt Enloe. Today we've got Rick Castaneda on the show, an old pal of mine who's got a new movie coming out called All Sorts. It's available to stream October 5th on all the places that you stream movies. If you live in New Orleans, it might be at a theater near you, or if you live in the greater Washington area, perhaps it's available for you to screen there. The film, again, is called All Sorts. You can go to allsortsmovie.com if you're curious about where it's playing theatrically, but also you can definitely check out all the cool stuff over there and pre-order it and all that stuff.
And in case you were wondering, yes, it is about sorting. It's a movie about competitive filing and filing cabinets, and it's crazy and funny, and you should check it out.
Charming and funny, and like, I guess magical realism is perhaps the genre that it operates in. It's got tons of cool visual gags that we talk about a little bit. It's a real treat to talk to Rick. I've known him for years. When I pitched him to Oren, I was like, oh, he's kind of like thoughtful and introspective. I would put him in the Tim Nakashi category of filmmaker, where he's got a lot of insights. This is his second film. He runs his own company. He's had two companies. I feel like there were a handful of like bullet pointed nuggets.
Yeah, and some great metaphors of how to think about filmmaking, which I really appreciated. Matt, before we talk to Rick, tell me, what have you been working on lately?
Well, I have a funny little anecdote for you here, Oren. I got some casting tapes for a new spot that I'm shooting later this month, and one of the characters is a director. It's one of those things where the director is really kind of there to like, for functional purposes,
Matt,
you know.
I kind of like what you're saying, but let's just like make it a little bit
a little
skinnier.
Tighter.
Tighter, sharper, and action.
A smile at the end.
No. When I say action, you go. And action.
Now? The lines are relatively minimal, but there's a lot of room for improv. There's a lot of other characters talking as they're performing and all of that stuff. So anyway, I get, you know, an email from my casting director today, and I get like just a laundry list of great actors, all of whom are basically improvising what they have witnessed directors do to them their entire careers. And it was such a treat. It was so funny. And also, you know, made me a little introspective. You know, you see a lot of people like listening and then taking notes and then like talking to someone or like silently whispering about a performance. All those little things that we do that we're kind of maybe hoping actors aren't clocking. They're seeing it all. And I saw all of the evidence today in my casting call.
Yeah. Hey, hot tip for you brand new directors. I imagine anyone that's directed anything already knows this, but don't whisper to someone after each take because your actors think that they're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Hurts their feelings. Even if it's like, that was great.
Yeah. Talk to the actor first. That was great. Hold on. We're just going to check something with the camera and then talk about their performance, whatever. So did you cast someone?
I have a strong reco. I'm having that meeting tomorrow to lock in casting.
Oh, cool. Any really funny things someone said?
My favorites were the ones who were not verbalizing a ton of their improv, that were just doing the mannerisms. I thought that was really the most pointed. And also, this, like I said, this character is relatively functional. So like, knowing that I could have somebody doing something sort of funny that's not pulling focus, like in the deep background, or just kind of like being a well-observed textural element, was really exciting to me. There were a lot of people who I think are really awesome improvisers, but kind of need to be in the spotlight, and like that won't work quite as well, basically, you know. It's the spot's not about them, basically, you know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was reinvigorating. This is a long time in coming. I've been working on this spot for a long time, so I'm excited to bring it to life. But Oren, enough about my casting. I have been dying to know what you have been working on lately.
Well, I will kind of answer you in a negative way, because I had kind of like a real bummer of a day today. You know, I know on the podcast, we try to keep things positive. We want to be encouraging. We want everyone to know that you can have a career as a filmmaker and a director. And hopefully from our guests and from us, you've realized that it's possible. But I do think that people appreciate the downturns as well as the upturns. And, you know, I joined this new production company kind of recently, and we did a spot together, and it was really fun. We shot in Nashville and talked about it a bunch. And I haven't really pitched on another job with them since then. And that was a couple months ago. And finally, we got a job. It's kind of a small job, like much lower budget than they usually do. But it was for a cool brand, and the creative was fun. Shot in LA, like all kind of the easy things. I'm like, okay, yeah, let's pitch on it. And so we scheduled the call with the agency today. And, you know, if you don't work in commercials, like you do this call with the agency before you write your treatment to kind of have them walk you through the creative. The EP at the production company, you know, he's the guy that's like on my team that's helping me with everything. We had a little talk before, and he's kind of coached me a little bit about these calls. Like, don't give too many ideas. Don't talk too much. Let them explain the thing. Be exciting. And there's something a little bit nerve-wracking about not only having to have great ideas and talk about these commercials in a positive, fun way and impress the agency with how cool you are and your confidence, but you also are having to impress your new team, you know? And a lot of times they're kind of texting you while you're talking, you know, they're like, hey, talk about this. Hey, bring this up. And a lot of times that stuff just really throws me off.
Getting a text mid-flow is kind of a bummer. Yeah.
Yeah. So he gave me sent me this text that said, take us through the characters one by one. And I was unclear if he meant that I should take the agency through the characters one by one, or if I should ask the agency to take me through the characters one by one.
Yeah. What did you say?
I was like, hey, so let's talk about the couple. You know, how do you guys picture them? Because like I love like how different they are from each other. And I think we can really build on that. And they're like, yeah, we were kind of thinking like the animatic, you know, whatever. They had some things to say. And I brought up like an idea and I thought was cool, that it was kind of had a lukewarm reception. But we talked a lot about the treatment and kind of the things that they were unsure about in the commercial, like how there's like a little kind of magical moment and how they wanted to figure out how I would do that. And they were really concerned about like the spokesperson of this brand being memorable and cool. I had like my marching orders for this treatment, and I thought the call went okay considering all those things. And then, you know, I've started gathering some images and started, you know, kind of thinking about how to write it. And then I got a call from the EP, and he said, hey, don't write. They're going to go another direction.
That sucks.
Yeah. Before, you know, I even like started working on the treatment.
Yeah.
And again, this was like a job. It was kind of like a smaller job. And a lot of times you go for the smaller jobs because they, in theory, are easier to get, you know? And I was just like really bummed. It was like, I guess they didn't like me from that call, you know? And I've been in situations where they've said, hey, we're going to do some calls with some directors, and then we're going to figure out
narrow it down to a treatment.
Yeah. And I've always written the treatment based on that. But I don't know if there was like nerves. There's like me trying to figure out how to make everyone happy, not to give too many ideas, not to give enough ideas. The guy that's on my team, the EP at my company, seems to think that I was like asking more questions as opposed to like having a conversation. But yeah, it was weird. It's, you know, film directing is weird because sometimes you're on like a long string of jobs like you are, and sometimes And I feel like I usually am. And sometimes you're on a little string of almost jobs and it's, you know, it's tough to keep going. So I was like, told my wife, and she was sympathetic. She's an actor. That's her life. Yeah. You know, this last couple of weeks, she's had like a few callbacks and some really amazing auditions. And we've like worked really hard. I mean, she literally buys new wardrobe like for every audition. Mm-hmm. She's just like puts everything into it. And, you know, you get a callback and then you don't hear anything ever again. And it's this life that we've chosen is just like really, it can be really hard. So I just went for a walk, you know. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, I'm just going to go for a walk. It's only 98 degrees at this point, down 5 degrees colder mm-hmm. than it was. I'm curious, do you ever, like, when you lose out on something, when you're really bummed, like, what do you do anything that kind of like gets your mind off of it? Because
I like to cook. Cooking is really nice because it's artistic. But you have to focus. You don't want to chop your finger off or whatever. And you're also like providing for your family. So it's kind of like a nice little win of like, oh, somebody, like people get to eat something delicious. I'm helping people out, but I also get to kind of like zone out. So I'll do that. I have lamented in recent weeks not having a good way to blow off steam. Like as the baby's old enough now that I'm kind of clawing back a little bit of time, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not quite so exhausted. We're into some routines, you know, it's not quite the sort of struggle that it was when she was first born. And so it's like, I don't know what to do with myself.
No, it's tricky for me too. It's like, I was really bummed and I have a lot of work to do. I'm working on this movie. I'm doing VFX and I, you know, I have this long to-do list of things I want to put on Instagram and things, my own project, but just like none of those would make me, you know, I just feel not better. In the headspace. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that mental health aspect of it. Like you'd mentioned that I'm on a hot streak, so to speak. I'm working a lot. I was like, dang, I could actually legitimately use a mental health day, just like a day to actually decompress or like think or clear my head.
Well, out of the blue, right after that, after my walk, I got a text from a friend of mine that was like, hey, do you want to go go-kart racing tomorrow?
Oh my God. Are you gonna?
Yeah, he's really into F1. And I was like, you mean like with the kids? He's like, no, these are like serious go-karts that go really fast. I'm not into F1, but I am into doing something with a friend that's like not just like having lunch. So speaking of friends, let's talk to your old pal, Rick Castaneda.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, we're here with Rick Castaneda. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Rick.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Longtime friend of Matt's from USC. You mentioned that you were not a film major. Did you have a major?
Yeah, I was in the English degree. I had a creative writing major.
Oh, well, so that's related.
I studied with T.C. Boyle, the American novelist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was really great. He really believed in his students, too. That was one of the best parts, is that he, you know, I went and talked to him during office hours. You know, he would begin class saying like, hey, look at this, you know, story in the New Yorker. It's by Bob, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, 4 years ago, he was sitting right here in this class, and you could be in the New Yorker in a few years. And, you know, like, he just really believed in us. And he has this thing called the archives. So he actually keeps a copy of every single one of his students' stories in this archive. And he would tell us that. He was like, oh, yeah, these are going in the archive. We didn't really have any idea what he was talking about. But later on, I found out that I think he sold all of his like academic papers and his like writings and his whole like, you know, body of writing and notes and things to, I think it was like the University of Texas or something. And I once got a Google alert because my name was part of that as part of the archives.
That's wild, man. That's, you know, like, I guess it pays to be a hoarder after all.
It felt important, you know, it felt like someone cares about my writing, even if no one else does, you know, like, so that kind of, and those kind of things stick with you. Hopefully you keep like a file folder in your brain for all of those like wonderful memories about your creative things. I know some people who they really focus on all the negative things, and like they keep all like most of the space in their brain is dedicated to all these bad memories that they can't get rid of. But I really have like a file folder just full of good things and good memories so that I can, you know, when I lose hope, I can kind of go back ahead to that.
So Rick, I want to get into your film, All Sorts, which premiered at the Seattle Film Festival. Congrats on that. Sounds awesome.
Thank you. Thanks.
I love the title. I love, you know, double entendres. This is your second feature, right?
Yeah.
And how, just real, just the one paragraph explanation of how you went from creative writing major to filmmaker.
So I went to USC. One of my friends was Doug Spice, who is also, you know, he worked on the same film as Matt and in college. And so I ended up starting a production company with Doug and a few other guys from school right after we graduated. And we were able to get like a project. And then we got a big enough project to have to like get an office together. And then we just kept getting on more projects. So we started a company called Psychic Bunny. And I probably worked for that company for about 15 years. As you know, Doug and I and Asa and Jesse, we were all the founders of that company. I never really wanted to own a company. That was never the point. I wanted to tell stories. And I love filmmaking. I think it's a very exciting way to tell stories where you're not just sitting in your room by yourself all alone all the time. So I find it's like a good balance to writing, is like becoming this huge collaborative effort, you know, a big group of people. And so I always kept that in mind that I wanted to be making these films. So that's kind of how the production company works, is that we like, you know, work for other people, save money, and then we would go out and make our own projects. And so now I have a new production company called Vibrant Penguin, but we're really trying to turn that corner from being a work for hire company to being more of an entertainment company.
Now, is it true that you used a Mad Libs book to come up with the names of your production companies?
The first one was based on a segment that we were writing for a technology company where we thought it would be really fun if everybody interviewed for that show was interviewed by this rabbit sitting next to a speaker that would just like telepathically ask questions to the person. And so we thought, okay, funny, that'll be a great, that's a great, you know, and everybody, I remember somebody was like, oh, that should be the name of our company. And everybody just kind of went, yeah, that would be a good name for a company. And we ended up spitballing like,
you weren't even going to start a company, but you had the name. That's usually the hardest part.
We were going to start a company because, you know, someone hired us and they didn't want to pay us as individuals. They wanted to only pay the company. And we were like, okay, sure. Because we were like college students at the time. We thought, okay, sure, we'll try this. And so we were looking for a name, and we ended up spitballing like 100 names out of that, but we ended up still sticking with Psychic Bunny. And with the Penguin, I had come up with a bunch of different names, but I realized that was the one that was like, I knew the most about, I could figure out how it would look. And that was pretty much it.
Vibrant Penguin you're talking about.
Yeah. Cause I wanted it to be like a black and white animal that was like very colorful, that kind of like was more creative than it was started out as.
I want to talk more about the filmmaking side of this, but I am curious, Rick, because yep. I remember when Psychic Bunny was just getting going, and like it always felt like a company that sort of happened by accident, and that you guys kind of kept going through inertia, right?
Yep.
And like, you know, you got those office building or the offices in that cool like building downtown, and it was fun and cool, but you guys were working super, super hard. I'm curious, because you said that you know, you were a creative writer who then kind of pivoted into filmmaking. And like we said, like we weren't planning on, or you never wanted to own your own company. And then that company went away, and then you did it again. So I am curious as to why you decided to get back into the production company game.
The Sushi Dragon happened. That was what dragged me back. So another, I was actually thinking about moving away from LA. It was like during the pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like going to move away from LA. I was like, I don't want to do any production during all of this.
Sure.
Like that seemed very annoying. And I was like, okay, maybe this is, you know, the time telling me to like, you know, pursue writing over like filmmaking necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I got this opportunity from a friend of mine to interview for the job of a showrunner for this new network called Ven, which is no longer in operation, but at the time it was very exciting. And I was like, and he told me it was a show for a dance, a avant-garde dance show. And I was like, what does that even mean? And I was like looking it up. And finally I found the sushi dragon on Twitch, which I, you know, Twitch was another thing that I was kind of scared of because it seemed like something new. Like,
and to clarify, Ven was a network on Twitch.
Ven was actually they called them a multi-channel network because it was, mm-hmm. I mean, but not an MCN like the old days. It was just like, you know, their shows were streaming live on Twitch, Twitter, Facebook.
Cross-platform live streaming sort of.
Yeah, exactly. Experience. And they were also like on Samsung TVs and like a few other things.
So, okay, well, that makes sense. Then you were like, okay, well, this is a cool job.
It was awesome. That was one of the like times where I just felt like, okay, this is exactly what I want to be doing. This is wonderful.
And it turned out that the show was less avant-garde dancing and more kind of like a glitchy...
It's like an interview variety show, right?
Yeah.
Interview parody variety show with a host who can virtual stream and changes backgrounds and controls all of like 20 different cameras with some joysticks that he holds in his hand.
Yeah, cool. So like, that show's like called... a cyberpunk talk show, basically.
Yeah.
And it's called Sushi Dragon, the Sushi Dragon show starring Sushi Dragon.
That's it. Yeah, and that became one of the best opportunities to just like, okay, we're going to start this new thing. I'm going to start a new company. We're going to do this show. And it was amazing. And, you know, I was able to hire a lot of people that, you know, I grew up working with. And, you know, I was able to hire Doug and have him make a segment of the show. Mm-hmm. It was just so much fun. It was incredible because it allows so much creativity, that show. You could really literally do anything.
You could do anything. Right. So that pulled you back in. But I'm curious, starting again, were there things that you wanted to do differently when one starts a production company in college? I imagine there are a lot of mistakes that you make over the years. Right. But so then to kind of have truly a clean slate on all of that, was there anything in particular that you were like, this time I'm going to make sure
we're not going to spend 200 grand on Kino flows.
Right.
I think we do have some Kino flows for sale if you know anybody's interested. No, so I would say the hardest thing to learn when I started was the business side of things. That was like the most difficult, you know, you don't want to talk about money. Reading contracts was a bore. It was really boring. And it was really difficult, you know, and I think over the years, I really kind of built that all up. I think the thing that I'm trying to do differently when this production company is not play it safe. I think that I like, you know, over the course of those 15 years with Psychic Bunny, I was always kind of like playing it safe. You know, we had employees. I wanted to make sure that we took care of them. I wanted to make sure that our partners could make rent. I wanted to, all of the decisions were based around safety, I think, of like, we want to make this a production company that keeps going. And I think with Vibram Penguin, I'm just like, who cares? You know, like if this production company isn't around in a year, then that's okay. Like, you know, there will be other things that I can do after that. So I'm trying to do my mentality now is like, just do it, just like get it done. And I think I have like a sticker somewhere on my desk that says valiantly making decisions, because I just want to be like, okay, I don't want to hem and haw more. I just want to like go after it and do it. And if there's like a question about like, well, but you know, taking this music video might wreck the company or something, then I'm like, okay, let's do it. Like if it's a music video I want to do, then I'm okay with not having a company if this is what breaks it. But so far, nothing's, you know, broken it.
Yeah, it's wild, man. Well, and so I think this is a perfect segue into how you approach feature filmmaking, basically, right? Like as a person who owns a company, has to keep the lights on, you know, you have responsibilities. I think Oren and I talk about on the show the way our lives have changed over the years. You have a young child now as well. You're married. You know, it's not like, if your first company had gone away after a year or two, it literally wouldn't be a huge deal at all. You know, you just kind of like figure it out and be fine. But like now you have a standard of living and then all of that. And also you continue to, on a regular basis, work on and support and nurture your feature film career, which is kind of the main reason I wanted to talk to you, right? It's like in a very homegrown way, both of your films are shot, you know, in your hometown, more or less. So talk to us a little bit about just the philosophy of how you approach your first film, Cement Suitcase, how you approached your second film, All Sorts, and what maybe that, where your head's at in terms of the next big project.
Making a film, making a feature film, making an indie feature film, actually probably making a studio feature film as well, is probably something that could break your life. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just so big. It's so much. It's like a hurricane, right? It just comes in, sweeps up all your time. If it's an indie, it's sweeping up all of your money. And, you know, the poor locations that you film in where you just like your whole, you know, filmmaking group swoops in and like, you know, moves all of the furniture around and everything. And hopefully you took pictures and you can move it all back in the right place. And you put down stuff on the floor so they don't get scratched. But it's a hurricane, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that both with movie one and movie two, I was worried that it was going to completely break the company, right? Because I started both of them during the Psychic Bunny years. And so, you know, when you're in a partnership with other people, then it's like, you know, if you're taking time off to do something creative and you're taking company resources to do something creative, there are limited resources that are not going to those other partners now. And so it was always very difficult to, you know, get that to happen. And with the second movie as well, I would say that I thought the second movie was going to be easier because I had done it before. And that did not turn out to be true. And I think one of the reasons is that every single time you make a movie, you're trying to do more than is possible, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you have a budget of $1 million, you're going to try to get a movie that looks like a $2 or $3 million movie. If you have a budget that is $10,000, you're trying to make it look like $100,000. And so you're always trying to like, and if your first movie, you know, got an A-, this time you're trying to go get an A, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think no matter what, you're trying to like push things to the limit. So what's really funny was that the first movie that I had, Cement Suitcase, we filmed all over you know, the valley in Washington State where we filmed, Yakima Valley. We filmed all the way from, you know, like probably over, you know, in 10 different towns. And we were doing like, you know, maybe three locations, maybe four locations in a day. And we were just like, because I was really trying to show off the area, you know, like that was my production value, was this beautiful area where everybody would give us permission to film. And my second film, I was like, that was too many location changes. I don't, you know, I'm going to set it all in one office and I'm going to film for more days so that I can really focus on the performances and really work with those actors and like really hone it down. But what I ended up doing was like increasing the cast. It was now like a, you know, ensemble as opposed to focusing on one person. And then I also like ballooned out in like props and like gags, jokes, and like visual, you know, visual effects. So because, you know, like if you're filming in one office, it gets pretty boring pretty fast. You have to keep mixing it up, throwing in new visual candy to like make it a different kind of thing. And so I ended up having to hire like four or five art people, whereas like the first film only had one. And, you know, that became the huge challenge of the movie, was like, how are we going to get all of this stuff that I've dreamed up and nobody's really figured out how to make yet?
What's an example of a crazy thing you dreamed up?
You know, like I had one character get sucked up into the ceiling, you know, which is like fine on its own, but it's like, you know, we have to figure out a way, okay, how is it going to get sucked on the ceiling? And I had an idea like, okay, we build a false ceiling and then people just lift them up through that, right? So then I talked to a friend, you know, that had helped with the first movie, and, you know, he has to go out and like buy all that stuff and like, you know, figure out, and he has to spend a day creating it. And then we were like, you know, shooting it like all night, trying to get it right and everything. And then, you know, it still needs some visual effects on it because you can still see like some things on the edge of frame. And it's like you just work and work and work, work. And then in the movie, it's like, that's it, right? Like, like all of that planning and everything was like less than a second of film.
Wait, and because you speed it up, or how do you do it? Or would it not have, could you have dropped him through the ceiling and then played it in reverse?
Well, nobody can fit in a ceiling for one thing. Like, you know, nobody, there aren't actually, like, you know, the tiles in the building that we were, you know, in, is like, you know, it's like a foot, you know, or something.
Yeah, but it's a crawl space. Yeah, yeah.
We're not, you just have like, to cast small.
So all of that time. And like, that's just one thing. So we had like a calendar we had to print. We had a sink that had to like spew coffee instead of water. We had driving shots, so those took some time. We had a paper clip that came to life. We had a filing cabinet that had to eat people. We had like a double decker filing cabinet because we wanted special challenges for these, you know, filing competition scenes. And all of those took lots of people to make.
Yeah, that stuff, like the sink that, you know, that has coffee in it instead of water. Like, it's so easy to write, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like in jobs, especially with Matt and I, you know, I've been doing a lot of commercial stuff lately. They'll just write like a unicorn walks in, or, you know, a confetti cannon explodes, or someone paints the wall like in Jackson Pollock style or whatever. And you're like, do you know how many people and how much like time it's going to take to figure out what this thing you wrote that actually doesn't really even make much sense for the script? And they're like, just do an Oren.
Yeah. We were doing pre-pro for a short film one time. And we're like, how much would it cost to rent an ostrich to teach it to pull a cart? And it turns out ostriches are like one of the less trainable animals.
And very mean. Very, very mean.
Their eggs are delicious.
We couldn't get our ostriches. Very disappointing. I think there are two things that I really wanted to improve on, two smaller things that I really want to improve on. One was, I think my first movie had a bad title. It was called Cement Suitcase, and it wasn't like a thriller where somebody's chopped up and put into a suitcase, which is kind of what it sounds like.
It's kind of like a lighthearted comedy in wine country.
So yeah. I knew I wanted to have like a good title. With the first film, I kept having to explain it over and over. And I was just like, man, this is just not like clicking. I think I read that Nora Ephron said like, if she couldn't come up with a good title for the movie idea that she had, she just scrapped it and like started something else. Which I thought was incredible. I was like, oh my God. Like, you know, I think as filmmakers, we don't really think a lot about selling, you know, like and about the marketing aspects, even though, you know, like the pitch, that's all what the pitch is about, right? Is like, can you sell it? Can this be an idea that sticks quickly in somebody's mind? And that changed a lot of how I thought about films instead of being kind of like, well, I'm not going to worry about the titles and like all of that stuff, man. I just want to make a cool, like an amazing piece of art.
If you build it, they will come sort of mentality.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think that there's like this first filmmaker type of thing where it's like, yeah, you don't get it because it's never been done. You know, like sure. that you're here to break the mold and make be noticed and do something unique and different. And people won't get it until they see it. And it's like, no, actually, they will never see it because they don't get it. You know,
it's I mean, I think of it even more as like aerodynamics. Like you don't want to be waving a stick with like a weird fluffy thing at the end of it. You know, I mean, you want to be waving a sword. You want it to like fly, like just cut through the air and just do exactly what you want it to do. And I think that that's kind of what I wanted to try to like get to. And I think the other thing is that like with the first movie, I felt like I was trying to like kind of halvesy it. So I was kind of making an artsy film, but I was also, I really want to make a film that people from the area would enjoy. And so I didn't make it, I didn't want to make it too weird because then I'd be like, what's this? You know, like that's, I'm a shopkeeper and that doesn't make any sense to me. So with this film, I was just like, this one's fully me. It's just like weird and strange and exactly the way I wanted to make it.
And that's your time at All Sorts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. So, I think the marketability is, that's a real second film lesson. You know what I mean? Like, I think to Oren, to your point of just like, well, I'm breaking the mold. There's a little bit of arrogance to kind of making any films, right? Like there is the sense of, or confidence maybe of just like, I have something that hundreds, thousands, millions of people are gonna like love. That's like a pretty bold statement, right? That we're all party to. Like we're all kind of like that's our deal. But then I think after, you know, a film doesn't do exactly what you're hoping, you don't become a superstar from it, and you're not, you know, just getting thrown, you know, studio deals left and right, you're like, well, maybe I should think about the way other people think about my film, or the way that I can explain it to other people, or, you know what I mean? Like,
and I don't think it's like, you know, not being the artist that you want to be, you know, it's not about that. It's not about like, I'm sacrificing this to get to a better place or something to get, you know, I'm not going to add a whole bunch of guns to my movie because that's what people want. It's really about, you know, this thing was clunky on the first film. I don't want it to be clunky on the second film. You know, like I want to get better at that. I want to get better at making good titles. You know, like there's a lot of times that I saw a movie because it had a really cool title and, you know, maybe not trying to fight that feeling of like, just because, you know, not fighting the feeling of like, maybe I should find a good title for this. Maybe that is important, you know, because I think that's maybe the feeling that you're talking about is, you know, first time filmmaker might say like, oh, I don't want to, you know, the title doesn't matter that much or something.
Or like they'll, once they see the movie, they'll get it, not realizing that the title is actually a marketing tool. Right. And also realizing, like, I love your metaphor of the sword, just realizing that, you know, as a filmmaker, it's like a mixed medium, you know, art, right? It's like you're mixing writing and acting and lighting and editing and all these things. And part of what you're mixing is the title, you know, like I actually just saw a movie the other day, a filmmaker friend of ours sent, and he was like, hey, here's, check this out. I would love to know what you think about it. And my biggest note to him, because there is like a very specific construct and he's broken the filmmaking form in this interesting way, and I was like, what if in your setup and in your marketing material you're like, hey, a movie like something you've never seen before, we're breaking the form, and then when I go to start watching the movie, I'm ready for that form breaking, and I'm not wondering when the movie is going to be like a normal movie that I expect it to be.
It's kind of like the first time you ever see like a single take film. If you didn't know that it was a single take film, you'd be like, wait, are they going to cut anytime soon? Yeah. Have they cut before? Did I miss it?
Although that was pretty exciting when I saw Birdman, I had no idea that was going to happen.
Oh, that's funny.
Really?
And so I was just like, oh, wow. Okay, this is what we're in for. Oh, this is, yeah, I'm in for this.
That's funny. Okay. That's it. What a surprise. What a
it's very exciting. Yeah.
I want to say one last thing about titles because, you know, I'm crazy about titles. The other thing you got to watch out for is, like, you know, temp love, like when you like love your color grade, love your temp score, mm-hmm. love your all your, those things because you've just gotten used to them. Like that can happen with titles too. Like you, if you have a title and everyone's like, yeah, this is, I don't know about the title. I don't know about the title, but you've been working on the project for so long that in your mind, this title, like there can be no other title. And you go into production, you know, and people are like, this is kind of a weird title. And you're like, yeah, it's just like a working title. Mm-hmm. Then you finish the movie and you're like, let's just use this title. Because everyone's used to it by now. It's been on all the call sheets and just be aware of that. That happened to me. I made this movie called Hamill. The first time I saw the script, I was like, Hamill, that title tells me nothing. And then it played at the Newport Beach Film Festival. And like these two women came out of the theater and one of them was like, I'm sorry. I thought it was about Dorothy Hamill. It was a sports movie called Hamill. And she was, you know, this famous ice skater. And so that's when I was like, ah, God, why did we not change? Every person that read the title was like, huh. And then we just ignored it because we were so used to it. Mm-hmm. And so just titles, if 10 people are like, it's a weird title, listen to them, okay? You're not smarter than everyone.
It does remind me of the rule that my wife walked away with for after See You Next Christmas, which is like, it's never going to fix itself. If you're like, I should change the title or the scene doesn't work or whatever, like no amount of improv or costuming or whatever, it's always going to bother you. It's never going to get better. It's never going to get fixed unless you just friggin' fix it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If it's a problem in the script, it's going to be a problem all the way through. I mean, there are like some small things that I think people don't really understand, you know, because you have the vision. Sometimes there are things that people don't really understand until they see the storyboards or like the final. I had one of my friends, and he's outside of the film industry, so that's like a huge part of it. But he came to me after all sorts and he was like, yeah, I read the script. And I was like, this is supposed to be funny? Like, you said it was a comedy? Like, I don't really get it. And then I saw you film it and I was just like, I don't know what he's doing. Like, why is he doing that? And you know, like, oh, he's on this scene for like for so long or whatever. And then, you know, in the movie theater, like it was all cut together with the sound effects. And I was like, oh, that's how that was supposed to be. Like, and I was like, oh yeah. See, like, I mean, that's why so many great directors, they go pitching in their movie, their big, huge, amazing blockbuster around. And nobody takes it because they don't see the same vision.
They don't get it. Yeah.
So there is something to that too.
I get so scared of making movies now, knowing that people are, you know, on their phones, they're doing other things, they're watching them on their computer, pausing, talking to other people. Like you can't have one detail that's said in one piece of dialogue that if you missed it, the whole movie doesn't work, you know?
I was actually talking about this with someone that, you know, so on Facebook, one of my friends who's an animator, a motion graphics VFX person, she posted about this quote from Phil Tippett where he was like, people today don't, you know, like directors today don't understand that, like, you know, artists get burned out and they frame, I'm not going to say that word, but frame screw, everything. Mm-hmm. And like, they're like, you know, we play this game of, does this look real? You know, and if you stare at it long enough, you'll find something, no matter what it is, you'll find something that doesn't look real. And you'll keep trying to like make iterations and change it and like keep working, you know, and we had to do 100 variations to make this like one stupid little VFX shot look real. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But, you know, and I think that that's true that you can overwork something to death. You can like, you know, care about one little detail more than anybody else will, and nobody's ever going to notice that. But I think also we're working in a different time now where, you know, people are taking screenshots and laughing about them on the internet, you know, and if they're, you know, before, if there was a mistake in a movie, nobody might ever see it or get a picture of it because it was on film, you know, like people who didn't have VCRs. This was like, you know, like, even if you had a VCR, maybe that's like, that's not really good enough to see what it's like.
If you see a mistake, what do? You rewind to right. confirm that, oh, I did see a mistake. Like, and, but you, if you couldn't do that because it right. was linear TV or right. a film, then yeah.
And who would you tell? You'd probably tell like three or four friends, like, take a look at this, but it wouldn't like spread across the nation. I do think we are living in a different time where things are nitpicked to death.
Sure.
But you yeah. just, but to me, that's a sign of success. It's like if they nitpick.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, look at, I'm actually doing some VFX now on a movie and
yeah.
I'm doing this characters looking through Instagram and clicking on a bunch of things and I have to build all these Instagram screens. And so I do a lot of screen recording of my own phone, but of course I do them at different times. And I realized today, I'm like, oh, she's like searching through this guy's profile, but you know, the time it's like 4:10 and now it's 2:15 and now it's 7:25. Mm-hmm. Like, is anyone, like part of me is like tempted to put it in because the director didn't notice. But I'm like, ooh, this would be a fun Easter egg. If people notice, it means, you know, there's this saying in film, I feel like probably some USC producer came up with it. But like the, if they notice that, then there's bigger problems in the movie type yeah. of saying. But to me, it's actually the reality is the opposite. Like if they start noticing that the time's off, means they're really watching this movie carefully, you know? I'm curious from your test screenings, so you said at least 100 people watched it. Were there any lessons that you learned from that that are kind of repeatable? Like something I learned from my first film, it was a sports film. And we had a lot of montages, you know, it was about this guy's life. He would go back home. He went to college, all these different things. He was growing as a human. And we probably had like 7 montages in the movie. And after the first screening, everyone's like, dude, you have to earn those montages. You can't just cut to a montage, cut to a montage, cut to a montage. And I think in the final film, we have maybe 3 montages. It's a thing that as a filmmaker, you want to show time passing and you got all these amazing shots of something. You want to use them. But as an audience member, it gets, a montage can get really boring really fast. So that was like one thing I learned from all of our test screenings. Was there anything that you learned from yours that's like, oh, I shouldn't do this again? Or like people don't care about my cool camera movement or pacing or music or anything.
I have a quick question about yours because I also want to learn from your trial, mistakes. Right? When you say earn a montage, does that mean like you have to set it up and like do work to get the montage to work? Or does it mean like, just, you know, you can only use a few of those?
I think it's a combination. Like if a montage, let's say it is a sports, let's say it's like Karate Kid type thing, you know, and we want to show that he's no good at karate and now he is good at karate. Right.
Right.
And so we're showing him really bad at 3 different things. Then we're showing him like almost giving up at those three things. And then we're showing him, you know, get humiliated, but fight back for some reason, you know, and then we're seeing him improve a little bit. And like his trainer, who's been a jerk this whole time, has like, just, you know, raises his eyebrows. And then we see that he succeeds in all those things. And now he's like actually pretty good at karate. That's good. You can have that sequence one time in the movie, but now he's going, he's won some tournaments and now there's this big challenge. He's got to fight this even better, you know, more difficult opponent. If we went through that same montage again, telling the same exact story, where he's not that good and he's getting better, I think it would be boring. So unless your montage is telling like a very different story, you know, the next time, I think it can get boring. And I think something that I did, especially on my first movie, is we shot in all these like beautiful locations in upstate New York. And I just like wanted to show, you know, cars driving and like establish these towns. And he's going to college. So let's get 5 different shots of students going to college. And now he's here by these waterfalls. Let's get 3 shots of him walking up to the waterfall. And it's like, dude, we get it. You established this place, you know, like we don't need 5 shots to establish everything.
I wonder, Oren, if you cut all of these montages, I have a hunch that the reason you were able to cut them is because they didn't have a ton of story or plot, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of like establishing and there was one beat in my movie where this guy decides to finally like help this his girlfriend is this deaf activist and he's kind of been ignoring the things she cares about the whole time, and then he realizes he's been a dick and he like wants to help her out, and we shot him basically going and doing this activism work. Like we realized it actually this sequence works better if he just like has a thought, and then we cut to him bringing all these signed forms back. Mm-hmm. You know, and we don't need to see him talking, interacting with 20 different college students to get these forms signed, you know, with like this fun, like poppy, folksy sure. music, which we shot. I mean, we shot, you know, we signed, got releases. We went to like 10 different locations around campus. Mm-hmm. We did all this stuff. We got, it was fun, you know, because he was like randomly asking real people to sign these things. We were filming like on these long lenses from far away, you know, kind of the end of the second act. By that point, people like they want to know what's important, and it just wasn't important.
Well, I mean, I think it's telling that your first example of a good montage is a training montage, because that has a ton of story that collapses time and has a ton of plot all in one. There's a reason that that's a trope. That's a cliche.
Yeah. You know what I mean? You can set up things that come back later, you know, like the crane kick, obviously, and the Karate Kid specifically. Mm-hmm. It's like this kind of meaningless like training exercise, but at the end, you know, he has to use it to win.
It's got to pay off. Spoiler, but I wonder if maybe there's some like to your point of like traveling and setting tone and all that stuff, like a travel montage, you know, tends to be a pet peeve of mine for sure. Like if a character's going from like one town to the next.
Right.
Do that.
Just do the Edgar Wright thing. Yeah. We're there.
Yeah. Or even the crappy, you know, drone shot. That's fine too.
I think everything in a movie, if you're doing it right, has to be somehow novel. You know, like you can't do the exact same training montage as Karate Kid, right? It's like, even if it's like really close, it's not going to fly. I always think of that with Die Hard in the end, where he has like, spoiler alert, but he has the gun taped to the back of his head. And I'm just like, nobody can ever use that gag in an action movie again, right?
Even though they have, but
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But when they have, it's bad because of that.
I mean, it's done. It's taken, right? And with every
they did that in Taken.
That comes out, it's that's good. So every movie that comes out, I feel like there's more and more things that are taken off the plate, you know, that you can use in your film. So with the travel montage, I think is you're doing something novel and interesting, like the director you mentioned, right? Where it's like,
you
know, not a lot of people did that with, you know, like before Edgar Wright did. But if you're like doing it like Edgar Wright now, no, you can't do like, that's not really going to help.
Trust
like,
me, I've tried Zoom many times. Get it, buddy.
So is there something that new that you can bring to this? Or do you
How about this? I was thinking like a shot of a map, kind of like an old timey parchment and like little dashed lines. Anyway, I'll tell you one other thing. I actually learned this on my first short film, but I had to relearn it again on my feature film, which is, you know, we're always like pumped with this idea that like we just need a lot of conflict, you know, conflict make it hard for a main character, make it, you know, like they have to fight, like the harder it is, the better the story. But like what people don't remind us is that we need to like our characters should be happy sometimes, you know, like it's nice to see a character smile or win or have a little success. And
someone should tell that to Christopher Nolan.
But there's something charming about seeing someone smile. And that's something that in my feature, it was a lot of like hardships that my main character faced. And I think at first it's like, he just keeps failing. It's like hard for me to keep rooting for him. And part of the recut was like pulling away, just literally lifting out some of like the big moments of failure that, again, seeing a character fail over and over in similar ways starts getting boring. So did you learn anything?
Yeah. So on the first film, I was trying to start the movie in a novel way, for me at least, which was like, it was narrated by the character and the character's like, this is me. I have this girlfriend. She's cheating on me. This is what's happening. This is how much money I have in my bank account. He was just like a list of all the things about him. And with the test screenings, that just wasn't working. And it took me a while to figure it out, but I just ended up having to take like one scene with him and his relationship first and putting that at the beginning of the movie to show that it wasn't working. And then he kind of like rattles off about himself and why it's not working. But I found that what I think was the reason that nobody that wasn't jiving with anybody was that people don't want to just be told everything at the beginning of a movie. They want to kind of like slowly, they want to like guess, right? They want to like look and see the character. They want to like find out how they feel about the character first before you say anything about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was like a big lesson. I was like, oh, nobody's done this before. And it like turns out there's a really good reason that's not in a film that way. You know, it's like, oh, it just doesn't work. People want to investigate more. They want to like be in this world and find things. They don't want, you know, you just to like stuff it in your face. Two big things on all sorts, I think, in the testing phase. One was don't finish your scenes too much.
Like every scene ended with someone walking out the door, closing it.
Everyone says, you know, goodbye on the telephone and then they hang up.
I mean, that's part of it, right? It's just like, don't make it feel like the end of a scene at the end of every like scene.
Right. You know, like a 5-minute scene in All Sorts where someone's like paying the bill, like waiting for their credit card to come back.
Like every one of them has to have momentum by like kind of not finishing. So if somebody asks a question like, well, what should we do? And then they say, let's go to the bank. And then the next scene's the bank.
Yeah.
Don't have them say like, let's go to the bank. Just say, what should we do?
And then cut to the bank.
You know, like,
Do that. Yeah. And might I suggest the cash register cha-ching sound effect at that moment?
Yeah. Pre-lap.
That is a good tip. My mom, who I'm sure is not listening to this. Sorry, mom, if you are. She shoots this like cooking show, this Jewish cooking show.
That's awesome.
Jewish people making things, and she shoots it on her iPhone and she edits it, but she does one shot, like one wide shot, and she'll do like slow zooms in and, you know, all these crossfades and things. And she was actually asked to shoot someone else's cooking show. And she's like, oh, I watch the stuff they shoot and it's not good. They're just like cutting. They're not using any crossfades. They're not using any sort of transitions. And I was like, well, mom, that's kind of the style now, you know, like ever since BuzzFeed and stuff, like no one really does these crossfades. And she's like, BuzzFeed, what's that? Do I need to watch BuzzFeed? I'm like, no, just like crossfades, like their only time you would ever use them in a movie or a TV show now is at the end of like an act, the end of a scene. And you want to just take your time and say this ended and now, and usually you'll kind of crossfade into an establishing shot, unless you're really like crossfading from someone saying like, I will never on my grave do this thing. And then you slowly fade to them doing that thing. Usually you would probably do a straight cut anyway to that, depending on the tone of the film.
Yeah. But who likes them? No one.
I don't know, unless they're specifically planned for a specific thing that makes a lot of sense and looks good visually. But otherwise, it's usually like a lot of trash right in the middle.
Just building on what you were saying, Rick, which is you can end the scene like when, like three times in the movie, you know, and it's a time when you want to give the audience like a pause. Maybe it's the end of an act. Maybe it's the end of a decision. Maybe it's Ben Affleck staring in the mirror, figuring out that he's got to do something about these guys to get him out of Iran, wherever they were. It is an Argo spoiler. Go on, Rick. Second thing.
The other thing too is like, you know, don't wait for applause after the joke. That's part of the first thing. Sorry. I'm not.
Don't wait for applause.
Don't wait. Like, as soon as the joke cut, you know, to something.
And then
else,
you play the laugh track.
Yeah, exactly. So the second thing was just don't be afraid of don't be afraid of reshoots because you're going to, I think, I don't know why I had this idea as a filmmaker earlier, but I always felt like it was like admission of failure where it was like, oh, I admitted I made a mistake and didn't film everything that I needed to film at the first time around. That's what a reshoot is, you know? And so I was always kind of against them. I don't know why, it doesn't make any sense. But with this film, I was like, I'm going to do as much as I possibly can to like get this movie to the place it needs to be. And one of the things that wasn't working in the first cut was the relationship, the romantic relationship between the two leads. And they, you know, people were just saying like, yeah, it's just doesn't feel right. You know, it doesn't feel like they're in love with each other. So we shot, like I wrote and we shot three extra scenes just with the two of them. And nobody ever questioned that again, you know, like, and it really worked and it really worked. And we took a whole day and we filmed a ton of little inserts that just helped explain little things that people were getting hooked up on. They just didn't understand that this was the same thing as that thing, or this person was also the person that's mentioned this time. And, you know, just getting these tight little insert shots here and there, just like the more connective tissue between everything else, so that the things that people were supposed to understand, they really did understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I seconded on the inserts in particular. And with See You Next Christmas, we did a lot of inserts. Inserts are pretty easy to double.
Yeah.
Is the other thing, right? Like, I am the hands of the romantic lead for an insert shot in the movie. You can't tell I'm wearing a different sweater. We don't look at all alike.
Yeah,
I just had the right props. And like, we found a sweater that was sort of similar and lit it right. And that was that.
Before we end the interview, can you tell us a little bit about like the distribution of all sorts?
So it's coming out October 5th. And it's coming out on, you know, Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, all the big streaming platforms. You know, it doesn't have any big stars. So we've been reaching out. We reached out to a ton of distributors. Some were interested, but, you know, nobody was interested in theatrical. And so that was something we really wanted to pursue. I found with the first film that I did, since we made it in the Yakima Valley, I was able to just call up a few movie theaters in the area and get them to play the film just by, you know, the fact that it's, you know, in the local area. And we were able to ask them for a 50-50 split. And we were able to actually make a little money from that, which was, you know, helpful because we had, you know, absolutely no marketing money or anything like that. And so it's really a DIY film. So we've been spreading it out as much as we possibly can. We found a list of every single movie theater across the United States. And we've been calling places up and emailing them and asking them to play the movie. And
these are just independent movie theaters? Like, you're not calling up AMCs? And
we tried calling up AMC. They had like a list and they had like a minimum of how much marketing money you need to put into your film. And so that didn't work out. They were really interested only in rentals.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't part of our plan to four-wall anything. So mostly, yeah, we've just been getting contact with independent movie theaters around the country. And we've had some success. You know, my film right now is playing in Juneau, Alaska tomorrow, and in New Orleans on Saturday. And then we're doing like a week run in Bremerton, Washington in a couple weeks. So that's something that we've been able to do. And another thing that was helpful was that we were in the Seattle International Film Festival. So that organization owns a few movie theaters in Washington and Seattle. And so they were able to program us for, you know, a week, which was really exciting. And we had a lot of fun. We flew there for the screening and whatnot. And I realized how important that is for marketing, because, you know, when you're playing a movie theater, I could see why that's a loss leader for a lot of films, because when you're playing a movie theater, it's on the marquee. It's in the newspaper a lot of times because they advertise in the newspaper. It's on their website. And if you go into the, you know, the movie theater, you see the poster there. So even if people aren't seeing the movie, it is pretty big. So we've been trying to like make this a win-win for the movie theaters. So we've been putting a lot of like, you know, time and effort into getting different press in different areas. But I think where we've been most successful is focusing on one area. So our movie was made in Washington State, and we really wanted to try to like saturate that area because we only have so many ad dollars. We can't market to try to like market in the entire United States. We'd be like dropping a penny in the ocean, trying to find it again.
And so, and when you say we're talking about really like you and your producer, basically, are kind of like a two-person band at this point.
Yeah, I have an employee at Vibrant Penguin who also helps like emailing PR and all of these things, which is something I've just kind of like learned over the years, is just like find an email on the internet, email them about your movie. And sometimes they answer and sometimes they want to interview you, and it's very exciting.
So when you say PR, like you mean like you're talking like local news stations and that sort of thing, or like who's your employee emailing?
Mostly like newspapers, radio stations, sometimes local like film professors, if there's like a college in the area, because we found that's a great way to reach people. And it also feels kind of cool giving back and talking with film students is so much fun. You get like so much energy from it. You know, we've been trying to find blogs, you know, film articles, you know, other things, and, you know, reviewers, right? So just kind of scraping Rotten Tomatoes basically and finding all the information for all the different reviewers that are a Rotten Tomato reviewer, and finding their Twitter address, finding their email, talking to them, you know, trying to get the word out about the film as much as possible.
So the strategy of like localizing, I think, is really interesting. So how many theaters in the greater Washington area were you kind of originally looking at? How many did you actually play? Walk us through kind of like maybe a success story and maybe something that you wouldn't do again?
I think I probably wouldn't try to email movie theaters across the United States again with this film of this size.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've tried a few and, like, you know, even done some Facebook marketing in those markets. And it's just too much of an uphill climb trying to get people to go to the movie theater to see this film they never heard of in a place that's never heard of you.
Do you think COVID has changed that? Like, it would have been easier pre-pandemic?
I think it would have definitely been easier because, like, a lot of the movie theaters that we've been talking to, they're like, oh, nobody, you know, like 10 people came to see this movie in Delaware. And then they're like, oh, but it was really warm this weekend. Nobody's came to see like any of the movies. It wasn't like huge. So we, like, for instance, and we played in Tacoma, Washington, and I was actually there for a screening, and I think we got, you know, 26 people. Mm-hmm. And, but that was more than Top Gun was getting. That was more than...
You're up against big movies and you have the biggest crowd, but it's
still isn't
a huge crowd. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 26 people is a lot of people. When you see them in a movie theater, you're like, dang.
Yeah. But we had one of the greatest, you know, Q&As that we've had because those people all stuck around and we actually, like, they had like a lounge area. So we all like sat there with coffee. It was just really fun.
And, yeah, that sounds awesome.
And sometimes those things like lead to further things. So one of the first trial runs that we did was in Spokane, which is like kind of on the eastern side of the state, but it's still far from where we filmed. And we just happened to call up like a movie theater and said, hey, can we play like one night in next month? And the guy said, sure. Hey, do you want to play all weekend? And we're like, yeah. And he's like, actually, do you want me to just keep it for the next week? And we're like, yeah, sure. You know, and that felt very good. And it just felt like they were getting something out of it because it was something interesting. Mm-hmm. And we were able to get a lot of press in that area. So it got the movie theater mentioned in Spokane in like the big newspaper there.
And do you give them like a poster and stuff to put up in the lobby?
Yeah, we, you know, we mail them posters. We send them some like small Instagram videos to like spread through their social media if they want to.
Yeah. And I think also newer theaters are just doing LED posters. So you just email them a JPEG.
I haven't seen that in any of the movie theaters we played so far, but that might be like, you know, like the bigger chains.
Well, I know like the Lemley theaters, the newer, the newer theaters have that. And I actually think, Oren, I think they do animated, they do support animated GIFs.
That's fun. You know, I'm hoping by kind of blanketing in the Washington State area and like really focusing there that it can lead to something, but we won't know until we figure out our, you know, until our streaming launch comes and we see if people really react to it or not.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you have a quick pitch on why people should watch the movie?
It's just so much fun. I think it is really fun. You know, people kind of like go into it and, you know, with their serious, like, oh, I'm just going to a movie face. And then they come out and I can see there's like been a difference in the way that they're thinking about their own life, the way they're thinking about something magical. It's definitely not everything everywhere all at once, but it fits that kind of vibe. It's different, you know, like I do think it's a different kind of movie. It's probably the best filing competition movie that come out this year. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, you know, something different.
Well, awesome. If people want to find out more about the movie, where should they go?
AllSortsMovie.com.
Before we hop into unpaid endorsements, I do want to say to everyone at home, AllSortsMovie.com is a legit good website.
I'll be the judge of that. Hold on.
Take a look. We're going to hear it, watch it in real time.
AllSortsMovie.com. Ooh, very cool.
Yeah, it's got great key art. It's got like awesome laurels. It animates very cleanly. The mailing list pops up.
You know what's awesome about it? I've been on it for at least 30 seconds now, and it still hasn't asked me if I want to accept cookies.
Accept cookies, yeah. So before we get into unpaid endorsements, Rick, who made your website, buddy? Did you?
Laura, my producer did. So we kind of worked on it a little bit together, but she was the one that really put everything together. Cure was done by an animator that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's animated for all the big shows. So it's pretty exciting that he was like, yeah, I want to do a movie poster. That would be fun. Randolph, he's incredible.
Is there a trailer?
We're currently trying to figure out how to launch our trailer because we want to launch it like kind of right before the movie comes out. And we're hoping to get maybe some sort of good placement for that.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, we haven't really figured out what we're where we're going or who we're going to try to pitch that to.
Well, keep us posted, Rick, because I guess trailer placement is, you know, a thing for sure.
I was trying to think what Randolph has worked on, and he's worked on Axe Cop, which I think is pretty awesome.
Oh, that is awesome. That's really awesome. Well, Rick, do you have a few more moments to hang out and endorse with us?
Yes.
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement, Oren, you're going to roll your eyes at me.
No, I already rolled them, just preemptively. I can tell that I'm not going to like it just from the timbre of your voice.
Other way around, you're going to be like, dude, I endorsed this 2 years ago. What have you been waiting for? So I went out to the photo supply store and bought myself a pair of Aputure MC lights, which I know are old news. They've been around for a long while. They're the little bricks. They're about the size of a deck of cards, a little bit bigger. They're about $90. They have a magnet on the back. You can dial in the colors. They have all sorts of fun presets. It can be like a paparazzi or fireworks or fire.
Trick your partner into thinking you're under arrest. Mm-hmm. Do it when they're high. It's the best.
Yeah, it's so fun. But they're just simple little lights. They're nice and bright. They have like a little rubber like diffusion on them. And the magnet is really awesome. You can just kind of throw them anywhere. And boy, they're so neat and fun. And like I said, they're $90. Hmm. And I don't know why it took me years to just grab a few. They're a great little tool to, like, if you're ever shooting something, if you ever need to, for instance, shoot an insert shot, having a few of those lights around, you're probably pretty close to good to go. It's really, truly incredible how cheap film gear is now. If you'd shown any of us an Aputure MC light in college and been like, this was $100, I can pick it up with my bare hands, it changes colors, I use my phone to control it, and like the battery lasts for forever, it would blow your fucking mind. They're great to have laying around. So that's my endorsement.
Okay, Rick, what do you get?
I was going to do a shout out to Liz Manischel. We actually hired her to be a consultant for our distribution. And it was one of the best money that we ever spent. Because I think, like, I've distributed a movie before, but that was like 8 years ago. And everything changes in about 30 days. Mm-hmm. For the whole game just changes in about the space of a couple months nowadays. And having someone that's like on your side that was not taking a percentage was like a huge thing for us. And I think that so many like sales agents and people in the distribution world just seem so shady and like don't really seem like they're on your side or seem like they're puffing smoke or something. And so having her, I guess blowing smoke is the right term, but having her on our side just felt like we knew more of, she was able to like learn us up real quick. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. You're also just kind of paying for a person to who's current. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, like you're saying, it's going so fast. It's kind of a full-time job. It's Liz's full-time job to stay up to date on who's doing what players are looking for, what are the going rates, what's the atmosphere like. And like, it's pretty hard to be an expert at building websites and distributing your film and all of the things. Basically, you kind of have to narrow it down and pick at least a few things if you want to be a full-time filmmaker and also maybe have a side hustle. And so the likelihood that you have a passion for knowing the ins and outs of the distribution world, you know, pretty low. So
yeah, pretty cool. Liz Manischel.
Kaplan, what you got, buddy?
Okay, I got this video. It's a commercial for a Lenovo Yoga Slim laptop called The Power to Just Be You. So if you look up on YouTube, Yoga Slim, The Power to Just Be You. It's a commercial for this new laptop from Lenovo that this guy, actually a listener of ours, Matt Ullery, hope I'm saying his last name correctly. I had lunch with him today and he showed me this commercial. And does anything seem strange about this commercial to you guys? Would you believe me if I told you?
All on an iPhone?
No, crazier than that. This entire commercial, there's no cameras used.
Wait, what?
It's 100% CG.
Wait, what? 100%
CG? 100%
CG.
These people are metahumans.
Oh, damn.
Fully, it's a great looking commercial for Lenovo laptops. Looks totally, totally real.
I'm not sure I believe you. It looks that real. Like, because there is animation in it as well.
Yeah, there's like obviously
avatars and stuff.
Yeah. But then there's the people, and they're metahumans. They're not real.
You looked at a frame and he was like, yes, this is a fake thing. This is
the
not.
Whole thing. Yeah. He thinks you can tell from the hands. Some of the movements aren't great, and that some of the clothes like don't wrinkle and things. I was like shocked and I couldn't believe it.
God, I think I'm going to barf. I don't know. This is like the end of the world. Part of what's baffling about it is that this is a totally shootable commercial. You know what I mean?
I'm definitely stunned by the fact that it's fake, but I do definitely believe it. That's where we're living now.
The hands are probably the most.
Yeah.
But the faces are incredible. Like the wrinkles in her cheeks, the woman's cheeks, and her hair.
I saw. Yeah. Hold on. There's some weird occlusion. There's the guy at boy.
What it looks like is that they're just using some really powerful makeup enhancement filter.
Yeah.
Like they're, yeah. They just seem too clean.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like someone took a selfie and then like used like the Facetune or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's totally bonkers. I sent you the article, Matt, that someone won an art competition with a Midjourney submission.
I've been trying Midjourney this week and it's completely addictive.
Yeah.
So the person I was talking to is a DP/director that showed me this commercial, and he's really worried. He's like, dude, this is going to be like, we're not going to have jobs. I just think it's too hard to get such a clean look. I think, you know, I have a team of really talented artists. And he said that they had a pretty big team working on this and a lot of outsourcing to other countries and things. But yeah, anyhow, if you don't know what metahumans are, they're these like photorealistic 3D human models that you can animate, and they are free. You can take them into any 3D program and render them. Like, clearly this wasn't rendered in Unreal. It looks too real.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. It's dizzying.
The last show that we did for Twitch was a show with Codemico. Are you familiar with Codemico? She's a virtual streamer. So she wears like a full body suit and just streams live on the internet as like a avatar, like a 3D avatar.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't she like the first avatar to be signed by like CAA or something like that?
Probably one of the first. Yeah. She quit her job. I think she quit her job at Nickelodeon as an animator and was like, during the pandemic, I'm just going to go ahead and do this, go full in. And now she's huge.
It's a crazy world.
She was a lot of fun to work with. And it's kind of neat where, you know, like someone can just like, she could just be on screen and like lift a car, you know, as part of like her set, you know, like as part
and
of
she
her
does
scene.
It live.
Yeah, she does it all live. It's streaming. So she has like one camera that's like in front of her face. That's like a cell phone. I think it's like just an iPhone that's filming her face. So she has one thing for face capture and then her bodysuit for everything else.
Crazy.
Nuts. So nuts. Okay, well, on that note, let's retire ourselves.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Time to get back in the shoebox tonight.
Recharged.
Well, Rick, thanks for coming on. You guys can check out more about Rick at vibrantpenguin.com. Are you on social media?
All Sorts Movie is the best handle because you can just find that everywhere: Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, etc.
Well, if you have questions for Rick and you don't want to reach out to him directly, you can always hit us up at Just Shoot It Pod across all social media, or at justshootitpod@gmail.com if you have a longer form question. And you can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media.
And I'm at Smitey Pyleg on Twitter. I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Check him out. He's at Noah Bayshore on TikTok. And the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.